From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! We're on the road in Spokane, Washington.
The two psychologists that I identified are James Elmer Mitchell and Bruce Jessen. They work out of an office in Spokane, Washington, Mitchell, Jessen, and Associates. And they are the ones who were, according to my sources, in charge of interrogation training at CIA black sites.
Today, we broadcast less than 3 miles from the headquarters of Mitchell, Jessen & Associates, the secretive CIA contractor that played a key role in developing the Bush administration's interrogation techniques, including waterboarding, sleep deprivation, and pain. We'll speak with 3 journalists who closely followed the story, then uranium mining in Washington State. We'll talk with a member of the Spokane Indian Reservation about the impact of radiation exposure caused by over 50 years of uranium mining. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're on the road in Spokane. In Sri Lanka, a government deadline for the surrender of Tamil Tiger rebels has passed, with the Tamils refusing to lay down their arms. The deadline prompted some 49,000 civilians to flee the Tamils' last remaining stronghold to avoid an expected intensified Sri Lankan military assault. Sri Lanka has been accused of indiscriminate bombings, while the Tamils have been accused of using the trapped civilians as human shields. An estimated 4,500 civilians have died in the fighting over the last 3 months. Aid groups have raised concerns of more civilian casualties, as up to 100,000 people remain trapped in the Tamil-controlled area. President Obama visited the CIA's Virginia headquarters Monday following last week's release of Bush administration memos authorizing torture techniques. Speaking before a raucous crowd, Obama refused to condemn the memo's contents outright, calling them, quote, potential mistakes.
Don't be discouraged that we have to acknowledge potentially we've made some mistakes. That's how we learn. But the fact that we are willing to acknowledge them and then move forward, that is precisely why I am proud to be President of the United States, and that's why you should be proud to be members of the CIA.
The Obama administration has said it opposes any effort to prosecute CIA interrogators who engaged in torture, as well as the Bush administration officials who authorized its use. On Monday, Senate Intelligence Committee Chair Dianne Feinstein asked Obama to hold off on ruling out prosecutions until her panel finishes an investigation over the next 6 months. President Obama, meanwhile, held a cabinet meeting at the White House where he laid out a plan to cut a collective $100 million from all government agencies.
I'm asking for all of them to identify at least $100 million in additional cuts to their administrative budgets, separate and apart from the work that Peter Orszag and the rest of our team are doing to go line by line with the budget and identify programmatic cuts that need to be made. And in the next few weeks, we expect to cut at least 100 current programs in the federal budget.
In Geneva, diplomats from 23 European nations walked out of a UN conference on racism Monday after Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad delivered a speech calling Israel a cruel and repressive racist regime. Audience members applauded as the diplomats exited the room.
بعد از جنگ جهانی دوم به بهانه قربانی شدن یهودیان و سوء استفاده از هولوکاست.
After World War II, under the pretext of Jewish suffering and by taking advantage of the Holocaust, they used aggression and military force to turn an entire nation into refugees. And they transplanted people from Europe, the United States, and other parts of the world into their land, establishing a thoroughly racist government in occupied Palestine.
واقع
The U.S. and several other nations are already boycotting the conference over concerns it'll criticize the Israeli government. Prior to the walkout, two protesters dressed in clown suits were removed after yelling at Ahmadinejad, quote, "You are a racist." Hundreds also protested Ahmadinejad outside the conference, including the Nobel laureate Elie Wiesel.
His presence is a scandal. A man who is the number one Holocaust denier in the world, a man who publicly, repeatedly said that he was going to destroy the people of Israel. His place is not at a place where we discuss human rights. He violates human rights. He preaches hatred, and therefore he should be in jail, actually, in Hague, for incitement of genocide.
The Israeli government and its supporters have accused Ahmadinejad of inciting genocide over a mistranslated 2005 speech. After the Geneva session, the Iranian president said Iran has been subject to repeated threats of violence from the Israeli government.
زمانی ما می توانیم صلح و برادری را تجربه کنیم.
We will be able to experience peace and brotherhood when we all develop a more tolerant vision and improve our capacity to listen to each other. Please pay attention to this last point. They threaten us with war. The Zionist regime threatens to take military actions against us again and again. But we do not believe in war. We think the solution to global problems should be based on humanitarian solutions, democratic solutions, based on the free votes of all nations.
In news from Iran, the Nobel Peace Prize laureate Shireen Ebadi has joined the defense team of the imprisoned Iranian-American journalist Rokhsana Saberi. A secret Iranian court sentenced her to 8 years in prison last week for allegedly spying for the United States. One of Iran's leading dissidents, Ebadi, will join Saberi's legal team as it appeals the conviction. On Monday, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton repeated U.S. calls for Saberi's immediate release.
We believe she should be freed immediately, the charges against her are baseless, and that she has been subjected to a process that has been non-transparent, unpredictable, arbitrary. And we hope that actions will be taken as soon as possible by the authorities in Iran, including the judiciary, to bring about the speedy release of Ms. Saberi and her return home.
In Iraq, at least three Iraqis were killed in a suicide attack on a meeting between U.S. soldiers and local officials in the city of Baquba. At least 11 other Iraqis were also injured, along with eight U.S. soldiers. Back in the United States, Democratic Congresswoman Jane Harman of California is coming under growing scrutiny over allegations she discussed trading political favors with an Israeli agent in 2005. CQ magazine reported Harman was overheard on an NSA wiretap telling a suspected Israeli agent she would lobby the Justice Department to reduce espionage-related charges against two officials of AIPAC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee. In exchange for Harman's help, the suspected Israeli agent reportedly pledged to help lobby Nancy Pelosi to appoint Harman chair of the House Intelligence Committee after the 2006 congressional elections. On Monday, Harman issued a statement denying lobbying the Justice Department about the two AIPAC officials, but she did not deny the allegations of her discussion with the suspected Israeli agent, nor did she address whether she tried to lobby the White House. President Obama's asked Congress to authorize a $100 billion grant to the International Monetary Fund. The funding boost would come as part of a $500 billion international commitment made at the G20 summit in London earlier this month. The White House has announced Obama will meet with credit card executives from the nation's top 14 banks later this week. The White House says Obama will lobby them to back new limits on lending abuses, including arbitrary interest rate hikes, premature late fees, and interest charges on debt paid on time. The inspector general overseeing the government bailout of Wall Street has revealed he is open 20 criminal investigations and six audits into whether tax dollars are being misused. In a new report released today, Neil Barofsky says the investigations focus on allegations including securities fraud, tax, insider trading, and public corruption. Meanwhile, Borofsky's also revealed the financial services wing of the auto giant Chrysler turned down government aid over new federal limits on executive pay. In his new report on the bailout, Borofsky says Chrysler Financial turned down $750 million earlier this year. Chrysler Financial's parent company, Chrysler's, received $4.5 billion in government loans. Chrysler Financial collected $1.5 billion in federal loans when less stringent pay limits were in place. Oakland has become the latest American city to hire private armed guards to carry out police duties. Oakland City Council recently voted to hire the company International Services to patrol troubled areas. Proponents say the move will save money for the cash-strapped city. Chicago's City Council recently proposed to grant private guards more responsibilities, including the authority to write traffic tickets. Former Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush have signed on to a joint appearance next month in Toronto, Canada. Clinton and Bush will appear together on stage in what organizers call a moderated conversation. Last month, Bush faced wide protests and calls for his arrest when he came to the Canadian city of Calgary for his first post-White House public speech. The lone surviving Somali pirate involved in the kidnapping of an American cargo captain earlier this month has been brought to face trial in the United States. The pirate is 19 years old. His name is Abdul Walimusi. He surrendered before U.S. Navy snipers shot his three accomplices aboard their boat. Musi is expected to be arraigned in a New York courtroom later today. In France, the state-controlled energy operator has admitted to infiltrating and spying on anti-nuclear activists across Europe. Pierre François, a former top security official for EDF, says he organized the spying since 2002. And in media news, the Pulitzer Prize winners for journalism were handed out Monday. The winners included Ryan Gabrielson and Paul Giblin of the East Valley Tribune in Mesa, Arizona. The duo won for their coverage of Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who's been accused of practicing discriminatory enforcement of federal immigration laws. Last month, the Justice Department opened a civil rights probe into Arpaio's immigration enforcement policies. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're on the road in Spokane, Washington, less than 3 miles from the headquarters of a secretive CIA contractor that played a key role in developing the Bush administration's interrogation methods. The firm, Mitchell, Jessen and Associates, is named after the two military psychologists who founded the company, James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen. Beginning in 2002, the CIA hired the psychologists to train interrogators in brutal techniques, including waterboarding, sleep deprivation, and pain. Both of the men had years of military training in a secretive program known as SEER, Survival, Evasion, Resistance, Escape, which teaches soldiers to endure captivity in enemy hands. Mitchell and Jessen reverse-engineered the tactics taught in SEER training for use on prisoners held in the CIA's secret prisons. The declassified torture memos released last week relied heavily on the advice of Mitchell and Jessen. In one memo, Justice Department attorney Jay Bybee wrote, quote, "Based on your research into the use of these methods at the SEER school and consultation with others with expertise in the field of psychology interrogation, you do not anticipate that any prolonged harm would result from the use of the waterboard." Well, today we're going to take a detailed look at Mitchell Jessen's role. We're joined now by three journalists who've closely followed the story. Catherine Eban joins us from New York. Her 2007 article in VanityFair.com, Rorschach and Awe, gave a detailed account of the role of James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen. Mark joins us. Mark Benjamin joins us from Washington, D.C., national correspondent for Salon.com. He wrote about Mitchell and Jessen in his 2007 article called The CIA's Torture Teachers. And here in Spokane, I'm joined by Karen Steele. She's a former reporter at the Spokesman Review, where she covered the story. We called Mitchell Jessen Associates, based here in Spokane, not far from these studios, to invite them on the show. But, well, we did not hear back from them. Mitchell and Jessen have avoided speaking to the media for years. 2 years ago, they released a statement to Vanity Fair that read, quote, "We're proud of the work we've done for our country." Well, Why don't we begin first with Mark Benjamin in Washington. How did you first hear of Mitchell and Jessen, Mitchell, Jessen and Associates?
I first heard of those two psychologists when I was doing my reporting a couple years ago from, frankly, from some of their associates and people that worked with them in the military. And their associates were concerned because this SEER training that you referred to, it's not designed to be an interrogation tool. It's designed to teach soldiers to resist, frankly, what are tools developed by communists, used by the Koreans, for example, during the Korean War, to force false confessions out of soldiers. And so we were teaching our soldiers how to, the SEER training teaches soldiers how to resist that kind of abuse. The reason it was brought to my attention is some of these Mitchell and Jessen's colleagues were very, very concerned that these guys had, quote, gotten their hands dirty, unquote, by reverse engineering these things. Frankly, their colleagues thought it was a very stupid idea for obvious reasons.
Catherine Eban, tell us a little about these two men, exactly who they are and what you found in this very comprehensive piece that you did called War, Shock, and Awe, the first piece.
Thanks very much, and it's nice to be here, Amy. You know, these were guys who have been described to me as op docs. They were, you know, PhDs who wanted to be sort of in the operational arena, which is a very seductive arena to be in, but effectively they were teachers and overseers of a SEER program where they were just monitoring, you know, the well-being of troops. They weren't scientists. They had no data, according to my sources, to show that if you reverse engineered these tactics, they would be effective in eliciting information. So, you know, the description that I got also from colleagues of theirs is that these guys were wannabes. You know, they were wannabe operational psychologists like, you know, the Jodie Foster's character in Silence of the Lambs, and they weren't. But apparently, and now we really see the extent of it, they were very convincing in selling the, you know, the use of these tactics to the CIA. And I guess it was a moment in time when our government was really desperate for any kind of solutions. But the fact that they landed on this without any data to justify its use, without any proof of effectiveness, is really what was remarkable to me in my reporting.
Mark Benjamin, well, both of you actually have now written new pieces. Mark, as you look at the torture memos, how does Mitchell Jessen fit in, these new documents that have been released? Well, pretty much unredacted. There are, you know, there it is blacked out, especially around the names of the people involved.
Well, we already knew, because of the reporting like mine and Catherine's, how crucial these psychologists were in developing the CIA's torture program. I think what the documents show is how crucial they were in carrying it out. In other words, if you look through these memos, these Justice Department memos, the whole rationale, you know, or the defense of the program from the Justice Department is that it's safe. You know, in other words, it's not torture according to doctors. And there are doctors there to monitor what's going on. There are doctors there to make sure that the person being interrogated doesn't die on them. And they have data allegedly showing that, you know, see this training, when we do it to soldiers, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't kill them and it doesn't make them, you know, crazy from the abuse they do during training, and so it must be okay. I mean, in other words, I don't think you can overemphasize the extent to which the Justice Department relied on the advice and consent and participation of these psychologists, not just in designing the program, but carrying it out and arguing that it was safe and that it wasn't torture. I mean, they were an absolutely vital part of this program, I mean, either in the room while these people were being tortured or watching on videotape.
Uh, Karen Doren-Steele, you were writing for the Spokesman Review, and after Mark Benjamin's piece came out, you did your first. Of course, this is a local story. We're broadcasting here at the PBS station in Spokane, KSPS. That's run by the Spokane Public Schools. Not 3 miles from here is the American Legion building. Tell us what you learned and the reports that you started to do here in Spokane.
Yeah, after we read Mark's piece, we did some research, Bill Moreland and I, on who these guys are. We pulled their corporate records and other records, and we found out that they had 120 employees, and they opened their rather large offices here in March of 2005, although they'd had contracts with the CIA prior to that. We learned that they came out of the SEER program, as has been discussed, and that they lived here because Spokane is a good place to live. They had many military connections here. These programs are still very big. The SEER program at Fairchild Air Force Base and the...
How far is Fairchild Air Force Base from here?
It's just about 3 miles west of town. It's very, very close. This is a big Air Force community. And the agency, the overarching agency that runs the SEER program nationwide also has a major facility here. It's called the Joint Personnel Recovery Agency. And sources within JPRA knew a lot about Mitchell and Jessen. They said they were self-promoters, they were cowboys, they disapproved of the kind of techniques and they're cozying up to the CIA. But they told us that they live here because it's a nice place to live. And even though their mailing address is Langley, Virginia, they're based in Spokane.
I understand Mitchell doesn't live here anymore, but
that's
Jessen
correct.
Does.
That's right.
And why was SEER big at Fairchild?
SEER was big at Fairchild because every pilot in the U.S. Air Force is required to go through this survival, evasion, resistance, and escape programming to learn what they might be subject to if they ever fell into the hands of an enemy that didn't follow the Geneva Accords. And, of course, we know that these techniques were reversed by Mitchell and Jessen for the CIA and the black sites overseas. We also followed rather closely the debate within the American Psychological Association about the ethics of psychologists participating in sites where they were arguably doing harm, not doing no harm, as their guidelines say. And APA distanced themselves from Mitchell and Jessen, so they were not APA members. But we found out that one of their board members, Joseph Matarazzo, who's an emeritus psychology professor at Oregon Health Sciences University in Portland, is a former president of the APA. And so after we broke that story, then the APA could no longer say there weren't ties between this organization and their organization.
We're going to break, then we're going to come back to this discussion. Our guest in studio, a former reporter with the Spokesman Review. Like many newspapers in this country, there have been a number of buyouts and layoffs at the paper here. Karen Doren-Steele is a George Polk Award-winning reporter for her work on the Hanford Reservation. We'll talk about that in a minute. But today we're talking in light of the memos that have just been released by the U.S. government about Jessen Mitchell, psychologists who run a firm here, well, that are involved in the coercive interrogations around the world. Our guests in New York, Catherine Eban, and in Washington, D.C., Mark Benjamin. We'll be back in a minute.
Until I die. child is in your hands now. So let's see you smile, 'cause I'm not impressed with your loneliness. And it's been a while since you forgave all your changes made. So let's count the miles together.
Swan of a Broken Heart. We're on the road here in Spokane, Washington, as we continue our Community Voices, Community Media 70-city tour. Tonight we'll be in Missoula, Montana. We'll be broadcasting from Missoula PBS tomorrow. We'll move on to Helena and then on to Bozeman tomorrow night, and the next day we'll be broadcasting from Bozeman. Then we're on to Boise, Idaho, and then to Los Angeles. Next week we'll be in Oklahoma, and we'll be in Madison, Wisconsin, and beyond. And we're looking for story ideas. If you've got ideas, go to stories@democracynow.org. Just send your email of story suggestions and people to contact at stories@democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Here in Spokane, we're broadcasting from the PBS station KSPS, run by the Spokane Public Schools. And we're talking about an institution, a company not 3 miles from here, operating out of the American Legion Hall in Spokane. Our guest here in studio is Karen Dorn-Steele, a George Polk Award-winning journalist. She wrote for the Spokesman Review a series of pieces on Jesson Mitchell. In Washington, D.C., Mark Benjamin. In New York, in our Firehouse studio, we're joined by Catherine Eban of Vanity Fair. I wanted to ask about Dick Cheney's latest comments. Dick Cheney is demanding that the CIA release memos that show that these enhanced interrogation techniques were effective. He said, what we authorized wasn't torture, but it worked. We got actionable intelligence from these techniques. Catherine Eban, from your research, what did you find?
Well, from my research, I found exactly the opposite, that there had been an FBI. The issue is very active over the detainee Abu Zubaydah. And there had been an FBI interrogation team with him initially, which had basically nursed him back to health after gunshot wounds and used rapport-building, classic rapport-building tactics, which is what the FBI excels at. And it was because of those tactics that he revealed that KSM Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was the architect of 9/11, and also revealed the name of Jose Padilla, and that, in fact, he was talking to interrogators until Mitchell showed up along with a CIA interrogation team, began imposing these harsh tactics, and Zubaydah clammed up. So in response to that, they made a request to accelerate these tactics. I think they refer to it in the memos that were just released as an intense pressure phase. Basically what my sources say is, sure, these tactics, these coercive tactics can get you to talk, but about what? So how do you verify the legitimacy of the information? Well, apparently under torture, Zubaydah gave investigators a lot of false leads, which ate up the time of American intelligence back at home. The debate is a very live one. There are people in the CIA who say these tactics absolutely worked, and I do think that this is going to be a central question of investigations as they go forward, is the effectiveness of these tactics, and people are now...
You know, I thought it was very interesting, Catherine Eban, how you described what happened. The FBI there, they're getting intelligence that they think is actually useful. George Tenet, then director of Central Intelligence, hears about this. He's very proud that intelligence is coming out from the interrogation. And then he's informed it's not coming from CIA interrogators. It's coming from FBI interrogators. And he hits the roof. And that's when they send in Jesson and the other CIA interrogators. You could take it from there.
Right. And let me just say that they sent in Mitchell. I don't believe that Jesson was there at that point. But it was interesting.
I mean Mitchell.
Mitchell Jessen, Mitchell's company at that point closed up shop about a day before, the day after Zubeda was captured. And then he was deployed to Thailand to the safe house where they were interrogating Zubeda. But what you had in this situation was a classic turf war. You know, you had the CIA wanting to take the credit for getting actionable intelligence. As soon as they started using these coercive tactics, it had a rather profound effect, which is that the FBI felt compelled to withdraw their investigators from the scene. The effect of that, the end result, is that the CIA had total control over these interrogations. So by using these coercive tactics, they also won a turf war.
Mark Benjamin, as you look at these torture memos right now, and the whole cachet around Mitchell Jessen, if you can call it that, around getting effective intelligence, when, as Catherine Eben was saying, it was the opposite.
Well, that's right. And when you look at the memos, there are even some hints there that show what interrogators have long believed, which is that these are not effective ways to gather intelligence. What Mitchell and Jessen were doing is just not an effective way of running an intelligence operation. And I would just add, you know, my reporting suggests that when the CIA put together this interrogation program, this torture program, they didn't involve any experienced interrogators. There were no interrogators involved. Nobody who knows how to effectively question a suspect set this thing up. The CIA didn't have anybody on board that knew how to do this stuff. I mean, it was people who just, frankly, didn't know what they were doing. I mean, they knew how to train soldiers how to resist torture, but not how to get effective intelligence. And in fact, if you look at the memos that came out last week, there's a reference in one of the memos to a CIA Inspector General report. And according to the reference, the CIA Inspector General criticized the CIA's own interrogation program, saying essentially they didn't know when somebody was being recalcitrant and wouldn't talk and when they just didn't know anything. That's the problem with torture. And so they ended up torturing people even though they'd already said everything they know. I mean, it was just that's the problem with torture. You don't know. I mean, how do you know when to torture somebody and when not to? How do you know when they're telling you the truth and when they're not? It's just, you know, and I think the memos, you know, while they're meant to back up and say that this torture program is defensible, I think if you look at them pretty closely, that facade starts to fall apart pretty fast.
Karen Dornsteel.
Yes, we interviewed two former SEER instructors here in Spokane, one person who's now a lawyer, another who's a psychologist. And the psychologist, Mark Mays, told us that the most important function of the psychologist in the legitimate SEER program is to make sure that the interrogators aren't going out of bounds, because when they do, you get bad information.
Mark Benjamin, we were both covering in 2007 the APA National Convention that was taking place in San Francisco. At that time, the dissident psychologists who wanted the APA to impose a ban on members participating in coercive interrogations lost. They ultimately found this loophole in the bylaws and found that they could put out the referendum to the membership instead of keep getting it voted down by the leadership. But what about the APA and Mitchell Jessen?
Well, you know, as we mentioned, Mitchell and Jessen were not members of the APA, but I think the sort of, you know, Reader's Digest version is that I think it's safe to say that the psychologists have been traditionally very, very close to the military. You know, they've been working with the military and the CIA for years, and are closer than, say, psychiatrists and other doctors. I think it's fair to say that the APA, the psychologists, as opposed to psychiatrists and doctors, have been much more willing since September 11th to play ball, essentially, to, you know, not remove themselves from interrogations as doctors and psychiatrists did, to continue to participate. And I think that's reflected in the way Mitchell and Jessen, you know, were so important here. I think the psychologists saw a way to be you know, players at the table, and that was reflected in their association and the APA. And the APA essentially allowed their, you know, wrote rules year after year after year, you know, that would allow the continued participation of psychologists in these brutal interrogations. And now that these memos have come out, I think it's really clear how important the government saw those psychologists were in having them in the room or watching on video or designing the program or carrying it out.
Catherine Eban, I think you'd like to chime in here as you talk with a number of top military psychologists and even those at the beginning who were recruited into an APA committee that would investigate whether psychologists should continue. People like Kleinman and others who you quote saying, "I think Mitchell and Jessen have caused more harm to American national security than they'll ever understand."
Yeah. I mean, what was interesting is that there was suspicion initially that the psychologists who participated on this APA committee that basically sort of approved participation in interrogations, that they were somehow behind these coercive tactics. What you really had was almost what I describe as a Wizard of Oz scenario. You had Mitchell and Jessen behind the curtain, driving, you know, the sort of good name of psychologists, as it were, into this very murky, dark area. And I think, you know, what's really important in the debate going forward among psychologists is the extent to which psychologists loaned their names and loaned their credentials and their PhDs to this kind of activity and essentially were used by the Bush administration to provide a kind of get-out-of-jail-free card for the people who were, you know, doing these interrogations, because the logic, which I think Mark had mentioned, is, you know, this circular logic. So long as there are trained psychologists from the SEER program who are on site at these interrogations, who are saying that these detainees are can withstand this treatment, are not being harmed psychologically, then it's not torture. So, you know, you've got this sort of cement tortured logic, which is the phrase that has come up, but it's this sort of self-justifying loop in which professionals are loaning their credentials to this kind of activity. And you see the same thing in the Office of Legal Counsel, where you have, you know, lawyers loaning their credentials to approving what are clear violations of the Geneva Conventions.
Karen Dorn-Steele, this is both a global issue and, as is usually the case, a local one, because Mitchell Jessen is right here in Spokane. There were local protests after your reports came out. Describe what happened.
Yes, so we're about a month after our first stories and some of the follow-ups on the APA debate. There was a street protest. Maybe 36 people showed up. Many of them were psychology students from local colleges who said, "Not in our names should this be done, and this is a violation of everything we've been taught in schools." And there were intelligence agents there. We couldn't determine who they were, but they were photographing everybody in the crowd. But Spokane is not a place that's given to street protests normally, although there have been some anti-Iraq war protests. But this was an unusual event, and it triggered some passion here.
And yet they continue, and they not only have Mitchell Jessen, but little other companies that are right in the American Legion Hall.
Yeah, there's a cluster of national security companies that all come out of this, out of the SEER and JPRA program that are still here and functioning.
I went over to the Spokesman Review yesterday and was speaking to the editor. I said, "Have you all ever been able to speak to Mitchell Jessen? I mean, they're a local company." And he said, "No, they do not."
No, respond. They just gave us the same response that you read earlier in the program, that they condemn torture.
Mark Benjamin, do you think we're going to see any arrests? Do you think, well, President Obama has said they're not going after CIA interrogators, questioners. What do you think?
No, I don't think we're going to see any arrests. And I think that the significance of what the Obama administration has done over the last few days, or announced over the last few days, has been largely missed, which is, if you look at the president's statements and you combine them with the statements of Rahm Emanuel, the chief of staff, and Eric Holder, the attorney general, if you put those together, you will see that over the last couple of days, the Obama administration has announced that no one not the people who carried out the torture program, or the people who designed the program, or the people that authorized the program, or the people who said that it was legal even though they knew that it frankly wasn't. None of those people will ever face charges. The Attorney General has announced that not only that, the government will pay the legal fees for anybody who is brought up on any charges anywhere in the world or has to go before Congress. They will be provided attorneys. And in not only that, they have given this blanket immunity, if you will, in return for nothing. I mean, in other words, you know, as you said at the top of the program, Obama yesterday, President Obama was at the CIA and called these things mistakes, even though they were very carefully designed. And hasn't demanded anything in return for this immunity. I mean, you know, in other words, it's not like the Obama administration said, "Hey, let's take a close look at this and let's have some people come forward and testify and let's take a close look at this program and see if the claims of former Vice President Dick Cheney are really true, that we really did get some good information out of this program, it really was effective." The Obama administration has demanded nothing and has announced, you know, effectively that the story's over and nobody will be held to account ever.
I want to thank you, Mark Benjamin of Salon.com in Washington, D.C., Catherine Eban in New York at the Firehouse Studio, VF.com. Your pieces appear. But before I say goodbye to you, Karen Dornsteel, I wanted to ask you about one other issue that is very close to here in Spokane, and it's the issue of the Hanford Reservation, for which your coverage, Wasteland, won a George Polk Award. Well, on Hanford, on the campaign trail last year, Senator Obama at the time was asked about the Hanford Nuclear Reservation cleanup. This is him being questioned at a campaign stop in Pendleton, Oregon, last May.
Every year, the government promises to fund the Hanford cleanup project in eastern Washington. And every year, they find a way to take away the funding, which in results a lot of lost jobs. Washington's current policy seems to be the solution to pollution is dilution.
Oh.
What is your policy?
Here's something that you will rarely hear from a politician, and that is, I'm not familiar with the Hanford site, and so I don't know exactly what's going on there. Now, having said that, I promise you I'll learn about it by the time I leave here on the ride back to the airport.
That was presidential candidate Obama. Karen Dornsteel, you're very familiar with the Hanford Reservation. Tell us very briefly what it is and what are the latest developments around this site.
Hanford is the nation's largest plutonium production complex that made the plutonium for the bomb dropped on Nagasaki. In the course of weapons production, it sent a lot of radiation into the air, contaminating the region. There's now a major lawsuit with over 2,000 plaintiffs wending its way through the federal courts. It was filed in 1991, seeking compensation. So far, the lawyers defending the government contractors have racked up about $60 million in defense costs, and not one sick person has received a dime. So it's a justice issue. Again, sovereign immunity is being claimed by the government, who and the government agreed to indemnify these contractors who came in.
How is it?
How
far is it from Spokane? How large is the Hanford Reservation?
Hanford is about 130 miles from Spokane, and it's about half the size of Maryland. It's a huge facility.
And who are these 2,000 people?
The 2,000 people were largely farmers and other rural people who lived in the vicinity from the mid-40s through the early 50s when the emissions from the plutonium factories, mostly of radioactive iodine, were the heaviest.
Hmm. And finally, your piece, Wasteland, was about the corruption and the amount of money that was spent.
That's correct. President Obama may not have heard of it, but this is a huge scandal in that $50 billion has been spent or will be spent over the 30 years that is planned to clean up Hanford, and there's been a lot of wasted money, and that's what we looked at.
Karen Dornsteel, I want to thank you for being with us. The Spokesman Review, you're no longer there. I went to the offices. I saw the big spaces, the desks replaced by couches now. So many people have, well, you took a buyout.
Yes, I did. It's sad. We're a privately owned company, and we've had a series of layoffs since 2001, just like newspapers nationwide, where it's tough times for the newspaper industry.
Thanks very much for being with us, and congratulations on the George Polk Award you won for Wasteland for your coverage of the Hanford Reservation. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we return here in Spokane from our break, we're going to talk about another kind of reservation, the Spokane Indian Reservation, and another kind of radioactive pollution. We'll talk about uranium mining and its effect on the Indian community here in Washington. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're on the road, community media, community voices. We're here in Spokane, Washington, broadcasting from the PBS station KSPS, run by the Spokane Public Schools. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, we go now from the contaminated Hanford nuclear site to a key part of nuclear weapons production and nuclear power generation, uranium mining. My next guest is Twella Abramson. She is with the Spokane Indian Reservation, where the only uranium mining in Washington State took place. The two mines on the reservation, Sherwood Mine and Midnight Mine, have not been active since the 80s, and the Midnight Mine was declared a Superfund site in 2000. The mine was operational from 1955 to 81 and now contains several open pits filled with heavy radioactive metals and water. Midnight Mine was operated by a subsidiary of the Denver-based Newmont USA Limited, one of the largest mining corporations in the world. It's long refused to pay for the cleanup of the mine. But last year, the Environmental Protection Agency won a lawsuit that requires Newmont and its subsidiary, Dawn Mining Company, to help pay for cleaning up the abandoned mine. Twella Abramson and her mother, Debbie, have founded SHAWL Society, which stands for Sovereignty, Health, Air, Water, and Land. It's a grassroots organization addressing the impact of radiation exposure caused by over a half century of uranium mining on the Spokane Reservation. Twella Abramson, welcome to Democracy Now! It's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
What are the issues you're facing right now on the reservation?
Well, definitely the environmental impacts have been devastating to the land out there. There's, you know, once were mountains, it's gone, and it's piles of waste rock that are left over. And for 20 years, during the first 20 years of operation, the mine ran without any water treatment at all. And so in 1981, they finally started treating the water. And now, even with the cleanup plan that's estimated about $280 million, it's treatment in perpetuity. So this, you know, will never be totally rid of this environmental impacts. And then that also impacts the culture of the tribe because we do rely on subsistence. And so fishing and hunting in that area.
Tell us about the Spokane Reservation, Spokane Indians, and the years of the uranium mining. How many were involved in the mining?
The Spokane Reservation is about 45 miles northwest of the city of Spokane. And when the mines opened, the workforce was largely tribal people. And a lot of women worked in the mines at that time. And so we've heard a lot of stories of women that worked there that were placed in certain positions because they were over childbearing age. And we've lost a lot of our people to illnesses related to, which we feel are related to the mine and the contaminants at the mine.
Why was it mainly women in the mines?
It wasn't mainly women, but there were a lot of women that worked there.
What do you think needs to be done now?
Well, there, you know, we're gradually making steps towards a cleanup, and I think just as long as, you know, the company and everybody maintains cooperation and works together to get the site as cleaned up and get it contained as possible and make it safer for our community.
What is your relationship with Newmont Mining?
Not great. they've fought it all the way. And so this recent decision is kind of a big one because they've definitely had the legal resources to fight, even though they could have used it towards cleaning up the site. They chose to fight their involvement in the first place. So
your mother is in Alaska right now for the Indigenous Peoples Global Summit on Climate Change?
Yes. And so that's also, you know, one of the things we look at beyond our own community, and it's the effect that, you know, nuclear power has all the way down the chain. And so that nuclear power isn't the save all to global warming.
It's interesting that she's in Alaska because Sarah Palin, as we travel today, we're going to be going to Sand Point, Idaho, and then we're moving on to Montana. But that area, Sand Point, is where Sarah Palin is from.
Oh, yeah. So.
Well, speaking of issues in the community, I wanted to turn now to a coalition of community activists, union members, and environmental groups that are here in the Spokane area that have begun gathering signatures to get a number of wide-ranging changes to the Spokane City Charter on the November 2009 general election ballot. The changes are part of a proposed community bill of rights drafted in a series of workshops and town hall meetings over the last year by a group called Envision Spokane. The changes include giving greater control to neighborhoods over new development, creating legally enforceable rights for the protection of the Spokane River, and guaranteeing access to affordable preventative health care. Supporters must gather 2,700 valid signatures from registered city voters by July 6th to get it placed on the general election ballot. Then a majority of voters have to approve the entire package in a straight up or down vote. Thomas Lindsay is also with us. He's an attorney serving as an advisor to Envision Spokane, joining us here at KSPS PBS Studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having us, Amy.
So what is this plan that you have?
Well, some folks would not probably normally think of Spokane as being a cutting-edge place for activism. But these 24 different groups that have come together, these labor union locals, environmental organizations, and neighborhood councils in Spokane, have actually come together to model a community bill of rights, which deals with a bunch of different issues from health care to housing to unionization to protecting the Spokane River to a greater extent from the pollution that it's been subjected to over the past couple decades.
Explain the community bill of rights.
It's actually, Spokane operates under a city home rule charter. Some cities in the United States operate under those, basically a local constitution for the city. And citizens can come together to actually petition to change that home rule charter. And the idea about driving in a bill of rights was to say to folks in Spokane and these groups that came forward to work on this project, to say, what aren't we getting over the past couple decades of our work? Because it seemed to some people that our conventional traditional activism was failing. In other words, writing letters to congressmen and doing what we perceive as traditional activism in terms of protesting and soliciting comments at regulatory hearings and those types of things, that folks have increasingly felt a need to seize their local government entities to actually begin to build their values into those frameworks of law, rather than simply waiting for other people to come and save us to do that work themselves. And so these folks have stepped forward to actually drive their values into the City Home Rule Charter here.
You're a part of this whole corporate charter movement. Explain what that is.
Well, it's an understanding that our activism is limited in the United States. We're, in essence, placed into a box, which is limited by something called corporate rights. Corporations today have the same constitutional rights as you or I, but because of their wealth, of course, they can exercise those rights to a greater extent. So even though you and I have First Amendment rights and Fourth Amendment rights and Bill of Rights protections under the U.S. system of law, corporations have those rights too. So Walmart Corporation, for example, has First Amendment rights and Fourth Amendment rights under the law. And what the folks in Spokane have started to say, as well as 100-some communities on the East Coast, which have begun passing these ordinances and laws as well, is that to say to themselves, we can't build a sustainable, environmentally, economically sustainable system if our activism is defined for us within that box. And so we need to break out of that box somehow. And one of the most amazing things about these particular Community Bill of Rights, which is being amended into the Spokane City Home Rule Charter, is that it actually deals with that, declaring in that Bill of Rights that corporations don't have rights that can actually exceed those rights of people within the city of Spokane. And so it's pretty groundbreaking stuff in addition.
Can you talk about Shapley, Maine, and how the Poland Springs decision would impact what you're talking mm-hmm. about here and what that is?
It's fascinating stuff happening in New England right now. You have Nestle Corporation, who owns Poland Springs, coming into several small communities, not just Shapley, but also Newfield and Wells, Barnstead, New Hampshire, Atkinson, New Hampshire, a bunch of different places. And instead of these activists saying to themselves, we're going to do the same thing that we've done for the past 40 years, which is go and beg and plead in front of a regulatory agency to try to limit the number of thousands of gallons that can come out of our aquifer in these communities, that these folks have moved forward and at town meetings have actually passed law that bans corporations from withdrawing water from within their aquifer, and then have also taken steps within those town meetings to strip corporations of those constitutional rights, which would normally be used to overturn those laws that are being passed in those areas. And so what's happening is almost like a grassroots revolt where people have said, we're not going to wait for the regulatory agencies to come in and save us. We're not going to wait for the Sierra Club to come in to save us. These rural, relatively conservative towns are rising up to seize their own lawmaking authority to say we are not going to allow the corporatization of water in these areas.
Thomas Lindsay, you've also been consulting with the government of Ecuador in rewriting its constitution. How does this relate?
Well, it's this concept that we've never really had an environmental movement in the United States, because our environmental movement has always been based on nature as property. In other words, if you own 10 acres of ground in the United States, it carries with it the legal ability to destroy the ecosystems on that 10-acre piece of property. What is increasingly growing is a realization that for a real environmental movement to occur, that ecosystems must have legally enforceable rights of their own. And so folks in Ecuador who are rewriting their constitution, their national constitution, heard about what was happening in the United States, because we have 13 municipalities in the United States now that have passed local laws that say that nature and ecosystems are no longer property, but actually have legally enforceable rights of their own. And Ecuador became the first country in the world to take that concept of moving to a rights-based environmental protection system and ensconce it into their national constitution. It's now law.
We have 10 seconds. But what would it take to get the Community Bill of Rights here in Spokane into the city charter?
Well, first it takes 2,800 signatures, and we're doing the signature gathering now to put it on the ballot. And then it's going to take about 25,000 votes within the city of Spokane. And what's amazing is you have environmental groups sitting down with labor union locals, sitting down with community organizations, folks that normally wouldn't sit down across from each other, who have actually unanimously endorsed these Community Bill of Rights.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Thomas Lindsay. Thank you. And Twala Abrahamson of the Spokane Indian Reservation, thanks so much for joining us. We'll be in Sand Point, Idaho, and then tonight we'll be in Missoula, Montana. You can check our website at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman.